3, 2, 1. Hi, I'm Joe Tate, and I have a podcast. It's called Over the Timeline. I look back at the highlights and a few lowlights of my sports broadcast career. Over the Timeline, brought to you by the Life Care Centers of Elyria, Westlake, and Medina.
With the first pick, the Cleveland Cavaliers select LeBron James.
Welcome back into another edition of the Over the Timeline podcast, brought to you by Life Care Centers of Elyria, Westlake, and Medina. Andy Bullbarch with you, and I am joined by Joe Tate. Joe, as always, a pleasure to have you on, my friend. We've had a lot of fun doing these podcasts, and well, we've touched on a number of different areas in your sports broadcasting career, and we're going to go to some more somewhat recent history. I want to talk about the LeBron years today, Joe, and it's such a fascinating chapter in Cleveland Cavaliers history because, well, I think for the 10 years from the end of that Price, Nance, Doherty era, there were some, well, low times for the Cavaliers for sure, but then all of a sudden, when they saw that they had drawn the number one pick in the NBA draft, everybody kind of knew it was a foregone conclusion that LeBron James would be coming to Cleveland, but at that time, as great as LeBron was as a high schooler, there had been so many others that were making the jump straight from high school to the NBA that didn't necessarily fare too well. So, Joe, let's start right there. Do you remember where you were when the Cavaliers found out that they would be drafting first overall, again, at a time where it seemed like a foregone conclusion that LeBron was going to be the man?
No, I think remembering it as I do, that we all knew that LeBron was coming to Cleveland, and so everyone was kind of preparing for what was going to come with LeBron to Cleveland. So as far as saying a specific moment where, hey, we just got LeBron, no, I don't remember that. I remember the Dan Gilbert's son picking the right envelope or ping pong ball or whatever they were using that particular year, which was kind of a nice touch, but yeah, it was something we knew was going to happen, and I really think the organization was prepping for it even before it became a fait accompli.
What were your initial impressions of LeBron? I remember reading a Sports Illustrated article many, many moons ago when LeBron had not quite set foot on an NBA court just yet, in an NBA uniform, that is. And I remember reading at the time, you know, a lot of people had predictions as to what they thought LeBron was going to be. And I remember, you know, reading an article where you were stated as saying, you know, LeBron, like many other young NBA players, is going to have to certainly earn his stripes. And, you know, some people were referring to him as King James already before he had even donned an NBA uniform. And you said, look, until I'm told otherwise, I'm just going to go ahead and call him LeBron. But by all accounts, it seemed like early on in his career, he was a very respectful young man.
I never had a moment's problem with LeBron. I wasn't a close personal acquaintance. I certainly was not what I would consider a friend. But then again, he was always cordial. Interestingly enough, the association that I developed, not because I tried, it just happened that way, was with his mom. She traveled a lot with the team in the plane, but she would make her own way to these various games, and I'd run into her at the pregame meals, the meals that they fed the players extremely well, probably still do. There's food on the table for basketball players virtually all hours of the day and night, so it was good to save the per diem money, and I happened to run into her a lot, and we'd sit and talk because LeBron was with his guys, and so she and I would sit and chat, and we became friends, and I liked her. She was very effervescent, and of course, it leads me to one of my most unforgettable moments, and I was away from it at the moment, but the night of the 3,000th broadcast, they had me down on the floor for the halftime thing, and my family were all upstairs in a loge that had been set aside for them, and during the halftime, as I was sitting down there on the floor, My son, who I don't think knows one side of the basketball from the other, looked over the edge, and he looked downstairs. He says, "Who's that lady sitting in my dad's lap?" And my wife, Jean, looked over. She said, "Oh, that's just LeBron's mom." And, I mean, that pretty well summed it up, because and I spent a lot of time cheering on the Cavaliers after ball games and eating these various meals. And she was a nice lady. I enjoyed getting to know her.
At what point along the way with LeBron did you realize that he was really going to be something special? Because he played on some teams early in his career that really weren't all that great, but how early on in his career did you realize that the Cavs really had something that was considered to be a once-in-a-lifetime type talent?
Andy, I'll tell you, it came the opening game out in Sacramento when everybody in the state of California turned out. The press that night was pressing, to say the least. And LeBron had not a fabulous game, but he had a game that fit right into the NBA, and you could tell that he was going to be great on that. And I knew that we were on to something really special that night, just watching him play and the way his teammates responded to him. And he, you know, it was almost like he said, "Hey, follow me, and I'll take you where you want to go." And it was not overnight by any stretch of the imagination, but it was a trip that took him to the NBA title, as it should have. Came close one time before, and then put it over the top in 16.
Now, in the past, I know you've talked about how the Cavaliers made some hires that were somewhat questionable as far as the head coach was concerned. And I think we talk about Paul Silas because I know you and I kind of agree on this. The Cavs probably should have hung on to Paul Silas a little bit longer, because I know you felt like Paul Silas was the kind of coach that LeBron James really kind of needed early on in his career.
Andy, you are so right. I recall knowing a little bit about Paul Silas in the relatively short period of time he was with us, and he would have been the perfect coach to coach LeBron, because he would have put enough father figure into it to really make it count. But unfortunately, Dan Gilbert at the time thought he knew more than anybody else in the world about basketball. And in spite of the fact, the opening press conference where Gordon Gund passed the reins of ownership over to Dan Gilbert, and Dan looked down at him and said, "Well, Gordon, do you have any words of advice?" And Gordon just said one word: patience. And that was a word that Dan didn't know, didn't understand, probably couldn't even spell, and he just took off like a rocket, which is why they call the field house what they call it today. But, he and Paul Silas did not mesh, and it was a shame because, as we've already stated, Paul Silas would have been an excellent coach for the formative years of LeBron James. I thought Paul Silas was an outstanding coach.
What were some of the elements about Paul Silas that really kind of stood out to you and made you believe that he would have been a great fit for LeBron, especially in those early years?
He did the Teddy Roosevelt, speak softly and carry a big stick. He was a man that, just from his demeanor, the way he held himself, the way he talked and all, you know, he wasn't a screamer, but he spoke with force and with power, and you knew where Paul was coming from at all times. And he would have been the father that LeBron evidently never had. And it's just too bad that we couldn't have seen that develop. I think it would have helped LeBron, and it certainly would have helped the organization.
We spoke earlier about trying to pinpoint the moment it was when you realized that LeBron was really going to be something special. Coming up a little bit later on, you know, I don't want to get too deep into comparisons, but, you know, people always compare him to a different number 23. So we'll have some fun with that a little bit later on, because you saw both of them extensively in their careers. We'll step aside and take a break. When we come back, we'll have some fun talking about the LeBron years, and we'll also dive into that 2006-2007 season. What a special one it was for the Cleveland Cavaliers. We'll get into that and more right after this on our Over the Timeline podcast, brought to you by Life Care Centers of Elyria, Westlake, and Medina.
He was a voice heard by Cleveland Cavalier and Cleveland Indians fans for decades.
There's a long drive to left field!
Until illness struck.
I've been at Life Care twice. Both times, they helped me fight my way back home. It wasn't easy, but I came back.
Meet Joe Tate.
Life Care helped get me back on my feet.
Real people, real heroes. Life Care Centers of America.
With locations in Elyria, Westlake, and Medina.
Everybody ready. The ball goes to Mo Williams. Mo looks. Looks, fires to LeBron, three ball in the air. He hit it! He hit it! He hit it! Cavaliers win! Cavaliers win the game, 96-95!
Welcome back into the Over the Timeline podcast, brought to you by Life Care Centers of Elyria, Westlake, and Medina. Andy Bulbarch joined alongside Joe Tate. Today we are talking about the LeBron years. And Joe, it's fascinating because, you know, just before the last commercial break we took, we were talking about the comparisons that have kind of come out about LeBron and how he compares to a different 23, one of which you and the Cavaliers saw many, many times in the late 80s and early 90s in Michael Jordan. And, you know, the comparisons early on in the career of LeBron James didn't seem to be fair because that set the bar so incredibly high. Now that we've got almost an entire body of work from LeBron, do you think that those comparisons to Michael Jordan are fair at this point?
Well, he certainly belongs in the same team picture with Michael Jordan. There's no doubt about it. I think maybe it was you or somebody there at the station I was talking to recently that I had heard a comparison given to me by a writer that I think really summed it up for me, the difference between Michael Jordan, LeBron James. And it was basically this: LeBron James is a winner. Michael Jordan is a killer. And yeah, I think it boils down to the fact, and boy, how many times did we watch when LeBron James decided it was time to win? LeBron just kind of tucked the ball under his arm like a fullback going off tackle and just plowed through. He provided me, when I was broadcasting, some great moments. There was a game in Detroit where he scored 24 of the last 25 points and single-handedly destroyed the Pistons. And then in the series that they beat Golden State for the title, LeBron, down 3-1, he just willed that team to win. And they just, it was like, follow me, men, and over the top he went, and they followed. All right, that's fine. I think that's beautiful. However, with Michael Jordan was the kind of a ball player that spent more time involving other members of the team at the championship level. Paxson's game winner, Steve Kerr's game winner come immediately to mind. Jordan, if he could have figured a way to put the trainer into the picture, he would have done it, because he believed in winning and getting it done no matter what it took. And that involved everybody wearing the same uniform he does. So that would be one of the basic differences that I saw between LeBron James and Michael Jordan. But they were both great, great players.
A few moments ago, you talked about the moment where LeBron went on a tear by himself, scoring 24 straight points in the victory over the Detroit Pistons, and that was in the Eastern Conference Championship back in 2007. That, of course, was the same year where the Cavaliers made their first trip to the NBA Finals. I want to come back to that season, and not necessarily that moment, but let's just go with that run in the playoffs, getting into the NBA Finals for the very first time. It seemed like, you know, it wasn't necessarily uncharted territory for the Cavaliers to get to the Eastern Conference Finals. They'd been there before, but with this group, and you look back at that roster now, outside of LeBron, you know, you take a look at the rest of the guys in that group, and you immediately think to yourself, that's not necessarily the roster you'd expect to be in the Eastern Conference Finals, let alone take down the Detroit Pistons, who had their own nice little run going there for a while. But what are some of the things outside of the moment in the game you just mentioned where LeBron went on that tear against the Pistons? What other moments kind of stand out to you about the playoffs in that particular season?
Well, in that season, the game that finally put the Pistons out of their misery was the next game in Cleveland when Boobie Gibson went crazy for 31. And, he kind of polished them off at the end. You're right. There probably was a better cast of characters with LeBron for the championship year than there certainly was when they made the run to the finals and ran into San Antonio, which was an outstanding basketball team coached by one of the greats in NBA coaching history. The San Antonio Spurs put them down with no problem whatsoever. And I think getting slapped to the face once in a while allows you to kind of refocus and realize just what you've got to do to win it all. And that's what that particular season was. But, it was a season that everybody got fired up. But I personally remember two things, Andy, about that season. One, San Antonio could have played the Cavaliers that year 100 times and probably beat them 98 out of 100. They were that much better. And two, that was my first experience dealing with the NBA and a championship round, how they found time to have a basketball game in the middle of that maelstrom of media and circus-like atmosphere. I don't know. It was almost as though, yeah, let's get this basketball game done so we can continue to do the hoopla. And that always bothered me. I never enjoyed that kind of an atmosphere. But then again, I'm old school, and it's very, very probably very good that I am sitting here chatting to you in my dotage about these things rather than still trying to wander around the NBA as, say, Tim Alcorn is this year. Tim's getting his feet wet, and just as I did when I started out back in 1970.
Well, and it's certainly not gotten a whole lot better as far as the media hoopla. It's probably only intensified tenfold since that 2007 NBA Finals. But can you remember, and I know if for those who have read your book, it's been a real ball, and it's a terrific read for those who've not had the chance to pick that up. It was referenced in there somewhere where you had kind of not necessarily poo-pooed the idea that the Cavaliers were going to the NBA Finals after they took down Detroit, but you tried to play it as level-headed as you possibly could, but there was a moment where you said, okay, you know what? You got me. This is pretty neat. Can you take us through that moment when the Cavaliers defeated the Detroit Pistons? I remember that game like it was yesterday. We were down in Greensboro, North Carolina. Our game, thankfully, had been rained out that night, so I had a chance to pop the game on television, and I remember distinctly seeing Rasheed Wallace get a technical foul that he was ejected from the game, and to me that was the holy crap moment. The Cavs are actually going to win this thing and go to the NBA Finals. Can you remember that night and when it kind of hits you that, wow, the Cavs are actually going to the NBA championship?
I can, and I must admit that I got a little bit, as they say in the horse racing game, up in the bit, and got a little excited, probably even a little too excited. But, I mean, I'd been there since 1970, and I discount the 2 years I was gone because that wasn't Cavalier basketball. That was some kind of a sideshow. The fact that this team, this organization, was going to the finals really did kind of sweep over me, and I got caught up in it right along with everybody else because I can remember, and someday, I just mentioned Tim, one of these days, the Cavaliers will be back on top. And when they do, Tim will remember this particular season that he's going through now, and it will mean much more to him when he's talking about a championship team.
And that whole playoff run, it was just so fun to listen to. It was a lot of fun to watch. And for you, I'm sure it was a lot of fun to be a part of as well. Because, you know, Joe, I think people expected that LeBron would arrive at some point. And you can make the argument that he had arrived prior to that season. He was already a very good player. But it was just so unexpected for the Cavs to knock off the Detroit Pistons, because at the time, they were really the cream of the crop in the NBA East for sure. So a lot of folks just didn't see this coming, especially when, again, with all due respect to the rest of the guys on that particular team that year, outside of LeBron, there really weren't any superstars. So I think the surprise element really kind of added more fuel to the fire there, didn't it?
It did. And you're absolutely right, Andy. It also, I think, emphasizes what I was saying earlier about LeBron, that he has such fantastic individual talent that he can take a mediocre group of guys and get them focused and get them aimed and then lead the charge up San Juan Hill and win the day. That's the kind of a ball player that LeBron was. He was a great one-man army when he had to be, and there were times when he had to be. And you go right to that championship year, LeBron James willed that team to come from a 3-1 deficit to win the title. I was not with the organization in those days, but I did turn it on for the seventh game, because I just knew LeBron was going to get him there. And in the championship game, the final, he was awesome. And, you know, I have to admit, I sat here and had a tear in the ear about the fact that they were on top. People said, well, did you get a ring? And, of course, they offered me a ring, and I refused. Personally, it was not my team. It would be like the Cleveland Browns winning the NFL title and saying, Joe, do you want a ring? I'd say, no, you're not. I'm not with that team. Well, I felt the same way about the Cavs. When I retired in 2011, that was it. They were going to dispense rings for 22 and 57 seasons. I would have picked one up and been happy to have it. But I wasn't around for the championship except as a spectator. So I passed on the ring, and I would do it again today.
I know at the very beginning of this podcast you did make mention of this, but I wanted to give you a chance to dispel this rumor again. For whatever reason, Joe, I'm not really sure how this started, but rumors start pretty easily these days. There was this strange message that was out there at the end of your broadcast career that you and LeBron didn't see eye to eye. You were very quick to dispel that, and I want to give you a chance to do that again, because you were very quick to say, look, I'm not sure where that started or who brought this up, but you know, you and LeBron, as you stated at the very beginning of this thing, you guys always had a very nice, cordial relationship.
I had a professional friendship with LeBron James. Did not know his inner work. I knew more about him personally because of my association with his mom rather than anything else, but LeBron always treated me well. And I made a deal with him before the start of each season that he would definitely agree to come out to at least one post-game interview when he had a big night. And he always was there. He never passed on it. So, you know, I have no idea where it started. I do know this, Andy. Social media being what it is today, and I've seen just enough social media to know it's like looking down the open hole of a two-holer. And for those of you who live out in the country, you know exactly what I'm talking about, because what you see down there is what you see when you examine social media. And I don't know who came up with it, don't care. There was nothing to it.
I've heard one particular story about you on social media. I will save that for a different podcast, because that's nonstop hilarity about the time the Cavaliers wanted you to give Twitter a try. That, my friend, is pure gold. I thought that was hilarious. That's one of my favorite Joe Tate stories of all time.
Well, Yeah, we're going to have to put an R rating on that one.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, Joe, this has been a lot of fun, as always, talking about the LeBron years and just how much fun that was. And, you know, I've mentioned many a times, I tried to watch and listen to as many games as I could, because during a healthy chunk of those LeBron years, I was living out of state. But there were times when I'd be driving from Charleston, West Virginia to my apartment in Cross Lanes, I would fire up the AM signal and I would be able to get Joe Tate calling those Cavalier playoff games. And I'm telling you, there was nothing like it. It was a lot of fun during those LeBron years, and especially for us here in Cleveland, a lot of fun for us to watch and for you to see and call games for LeBron, because he certainly is a treasure and one of the absolute greatest ever to do it.
Absolutely. Andy, always good talking to you. And believe me, I walk away from my years with the Cavaliers with a very positive feeling about LeBron James.
Joe, thank you as always, my friend. Always a pleasure. This has been a lot of fun as always. Time for us to wrap this baby up. Our thanks to Joe for joining us. Our thanks to all of you for listening as well. For Joe Tate, this is Andy Bulbarch saying thank you again for tuning in to today's edition of the Over the Timeline podcast, brought to you by Life Care Centers of Elyria, Westlake, and Medina.